Thank you, everybody, for coming. This session is number 315, Mapping Many Mormonisms. Please remember to turn off your cell phones. Keep in mind that the mission of Sunstone is to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue, so please keep that in mind. The session is being recorded, and you can purchase the recordings afterwards. If you have questions, feel free to come up and ask me afterwards. The session is 60 minutes long. And so during the question and answer, please make sure you keep things short. And please don't talk during the session. It's very distracting. So our blurb today about this awesome session is John has created hundreds of maps and diagrams which outline the relationships, geographical, historical, and conceptual, between the many expressions of Mormonism. This presentation will visually map the schisms and connections between the many branches of Mormonism using dozens of original maps and diagrams. So John Hamer is the pastor of the Downtown Toronto Congregation of Community of Christ, a past president of the John Whitmer Historical Association. He is co-editor of Scattering the Saints, Schism Within Mormonism. And I am especially honored to moderate this session because at my first Sunstone in 2012, John was one of the first people that I met, and we got to talking about the many Mormonisms and many sects of Mormonisms, and it was the first time that I had learned about a lot of them, and so for me it's very much coming full circle to be able to be here today and introduce John, so please give him a warm welcome.
Thank you so much, and thanks for coming here so bright and early. I'm really excited to be back at Sunstone. I love coming here every year. I think it's been over maybe a dozen years that we've come. And so over time, it's just so many familiar faces. And what I want to talk about, I've done actually, like Hannah has pointed out, I've been, ever since I got into the Latter-day Saint history, that's been my heritage, but my background prior to that in graduate school was in medieval European history. And I did mapping for museum design. I feel like I'm standing too close to this. Is it working? Or is it these other microphones? I don't know. Anyway, hopefully the ringing will not kill you guys as in the ears. But in the course of that, in the course of starting to get involved with Latter-day Saint history, with Mormon history, since map design and illustration and publishing are one of my passions, I started also doing a lot of illustration projects for everybody from, I've illustrated books that are published by BYU Press, the Joseph Smith Papers Project, the Community of Christ Press, to Greg Coford and Journal of Mormon History, Mormon Historical Studies, the JWHA Press, and on and on and on. So over time, I started putting all kinds of different maps together, and I'm just going to, there's just been a bazillion of them. I can't show all the maps, but I love maps. So maps have always been, ever since very early in my very early in my life, something that I've loved. One of the very, very earliest things my mother drew as a kid as an artist, and my mother actually did a great job of putting dates on all of the little pictures that I draw and put them into folders and file folders, and so I actually have all of the different drawings that I have going back to the very early 70s, 1972 and stuff. And one of the very earliest is a pretty good map of the United States with all of the states that it doesn't necessarily look like it was copied. So anyway, I can still do that. All right, so maps. In our 21st century worldview, our relationship with maps has actually changed an awful lot just in our own lifetime. And so in this particular... And so that's been changed. Thank you. Thank you. So you are all probably way more than me. I'm very bad with this thing. But anyway, you probably are all have a very close relationship with maps, as you maybe even got here. You might have even just said to your phone, go to the University of Utah, or something like that. Certainly in the Locke who drove me here did that. And so anyway, so we all have kind of like maps that we are now very intimately related to and that we're carrying around with us. And in fact, we are viewing our world in a way where we are constantly thinking of the map and where we are on the map. And it's something that, though, is actually quite a new phenomenon. And so not only are we aware that the GPS is new, but in fact, even just the thing about the old days when we used to travel and we had these big fold-out maps and you're in the car and you've got them, you know, all over you and everything like that, that also was new. In the past, people did not actually think of things based on a map because they didn't have that kind of a luxury. Instead, when they were thinking of a trip, they would think of it entirely in terms of an itinerary. So what you'd essentially have is you'd have a list. You go to this town, then this town, then this town, then this town, then this town, and then you would be there. And so they would write out itinerary lists, and everything was thought of relationally then. So you would always have in your mind a relationship of those strings of lines of itineraries and things like that. And so when people try to do this thing, this enterprise, where they're making, for example, a map of the Book of Mormon, what map would Joseph Smith have had in his head? In point of fact, he probably wouldn't have had a map at all. People, the idea of when they were mapping, when people started mapping the Book of Mormon is when people started having map worldviews, you know, and that's when we've started putting that together in the late 19th century, the first maps of the Book of Mormon. So, maps. Maps are very powerful tools. So maps allow historians, like myself, to organize information differently than traditional narrative. So normally in history, you are writing a narrative and you are telling one thing after another. You're telling story and you're usually relating them chronologically, but you can also relate things topically. One thing that happens with maps is that you can show different things next to each other that are not having to happen chronologically or anything like that. So in this case, this is a map of Missouri, and it's showing, for example, the free and slave populations of Missouri in 1830 when the Latter-day Saints first got out there. And without this, how would you know that, look, everybody is entirely dependent on the rivers, and you can see that where do they live? They live along the rivers. And you can see where slavery is extending into Missouri. And so anyway, there are tools like this that allow us to show things that you wouldn't otherwise see just by reading a traditional narrative history. We can discover things as a result of that. Same thing here, that lower map is showing Independence at the edge of this Santa Fe Trail and the connection through the trails to Mexico and the West and everything. One of the things that I did in one of the many hats in previous careers that I had was I used to design maps and also exhibit panels for museums. And so I did the Strategic Air Command Museum in Omaha. And so one of the things that we did in doing that was show the beautiful Cold War style maps. So this idea of, the mindset. We're trying to get into the mindset of the people during the Cold War. And so we have this incredible blue good zone of NATO, and then this cancer of the Soviet bloc that is, you know, essentially coming to take over the whole world and the Iron Curtain. And so that's how maybe traditionally on this Mercator map, this would be portrayed, because it makes Siberia so much more scary maybe than it otherwise might be. I mean, here we have, of course, Greenland, you know, being bigger than Africa, much less, you know. So in other words, there are things that you can get out of a Mercator projection map, but there are things that are distortions on a Mercator projection map. So if you have this particular map, this is another way to look at it. This is out of the Times Atlas of World History. If you look at it this way, you can actually see from a kind of a polar perspective that the Soviet Union and its allies were really quite hemmed in and entirely surrounded by NATO and their allies, right? And so if you look at it a different way, it might have been that we were threatening them, if we were thinking of it from the NATO perspective. So likewise, there's all sorts of ways that we are reflecting biases in maps. So in this particular map of colonial times, all we show here ever when we do these is, what are the European claims? Europeans aren't in any of those places. These are all owned by indigenous peoples. All of this place is settled by and have been the lands of traditional peoples. And yet, you know, all of our maps of that are just showing, you know, completely extravagant European claims on the territories. You know, we also do this thing where we put north at the top for some reason, you know, and so that makes us picture maps a particular way when we're doing that. That's not the way it always has been in all of history. The reason why we say when we look at a map that we want to orient ourselves, that means put map north at the top, right? Because the word orient means north. No, because obviously all of history, Christian maps, Western maps, Roman maps always had east at the top. And so it's only been in modern times that that's switched and we put north at the top. So This is just another one. I'm a medievalist, so they always show this thing where the that whole giant area on the left is owned by the Plantagenet kings. So it's Angevin Empire. They had controlled all of France and all of England, and the kings of France only had that little royal domain. But again, all they're showing is the king of France's actual domain, and not the various areas of France that he has claim to, which is all of France. And here they're not just showing Henry's domain here. He's actually showing all of his lands that he has claim to, right? So in other words, this map is deceptive because we're not seeing the domain lands that Henry is himself personally over top of. We also see these every single time we have a presidential election year. You know, so this is 2008. The amount of space, because people who vote Republican live in vast and unpopulated areas of the country, and people who vote Democratic live in all on top of each other in apartment buildings in the cities. As a result of that, when you look at the first map, just state by state, it may well be, you know, if you didn't know any different about the population of those states, that it could have been a tie or something like that. But if you do it by electors, which is the next one on the right, then you see, okay, yeah, it's very clear that Obama beat McCain. If you do it by just the counties, you're like, did anybody vote for, you know, Obama? And so again, if you do it by those of that, and the last one there has circles to show the population sizes, and you see again that the population is polarized and concentrated in the rural and urban areas. One of the things that we have in the Latter-day Saint tradition is we have what I call the traditional Mormon map. So the church starts in Palmyra, goes to Kirtland, goes to Missouri, goes to Nauvoo, goes to Winter Quarters, goes to Salt Lake. And that is the map that we always see. That's the map that's in the encyclopedia when you look it up. And it's often just shown like this on a USA, you know, as if they're just going along, you know, in the United States as it is today. As opposed to, let's say, if we were to take the boundaries as of 1844, these boundaries actually had been shifting all kinds of ways, you know, up to 1844. But if I just pick one date there, well, then you see that when they got out to Missouri, they really are on the edge of the European settled area, and at the edge of Indian territory. They really are on the borders of the Lamanites, as they said when they were in the center place. And also when they get up to Salt Lake, it's still Mexico, although the war is ongoing. That said, there was more complexity to it. So it's not like everybody came from Palmyra. It's not like the Missouri period is clean and easy, and you know, so they just went to far west and that's it. There had been the settlement in Independence. They'd been in Clay County. People had been going there the entire early Kirtland period. It's not like they just went from the one. So there's complexity to that in the map. And by the way, not everybody went west, and that's sort of the topic that we have today. So, you know, other people, other different groups went different ways. So we have the Whiteites who went down to Texas, and I came, drove today with John White, who is a descendant of Lyman White. Then we have all those other ones up the Purple up there, the Strangites up in Beaver Island in Wisconsin, the Cutlerites up in Minnesota there in yellow, the Rigdonites going back to Pennsylvania in blue, and then the reorganization kind of sticking there in the Middle West in green. So the traditional history map, I always ask, I say, okay, who actually did that? Who started in Palmyra? Who went to Kirtland? Who went to Independence, Far West, Nauvoo, Winter Quarters, and Salt Lake? Who did that? So that's like the map that we see. But who went on that map, you know? It certainly wasn't Joseph Smith. So he was doing a bunch of going around to Harmony and that kind of thing at the beginning. He didn't get to Independence. He went and visited them, but he didn't live in Independence. So he went there, and he stopped, obviously, in Carthage, right? That's the end of his path. So he didn't actually go west. Heber Kimball and Brigham Young had close to it. They didn't start in Palmyra. They started in other places in New York. The answer is Porter Rockwell. He's the only one. No, he was probably one of the few who actually did that whole map, Mormon history map. But other people had other paths, right? So the Whitmer family and their in-laws, Hiram Page, the early witnesses, they ended up staying in Missouri. They were excommunicated from the church there, and they stayed there and reorganized a Whitmerite church there. Cutlerites, they ended up staying in, or Alphaeus Cutler, the Cutlerites went on, but anyway, he ended up staying at the border there of Omaha in Iowa, where this is fertile land. Why, he says to himself, why should I go out to some desert when the end times are coming, and I can just go down the Missouri River just a little ways here and I will be in Jackson County. There's no point in crossing and crossing back. Joseph III ultimately regathered back to Independence. Edward Partridge didn't make it all the way. He died. Martin Harris, he stopped in Kirtland. In the end of his life, he went out to Utah because of he had relatives. Parley Pratt went all over the place. Lyman White, we mentioned, went to Texas. Oliver Cowdery had left the church, or like the other witnesses in Missouri, but moved on to Ohio, then checked out the Strangites, didn't like them in Wisconsin, visited with the Brighamites in winter quarters, and then stayed and ended his life with the Whitmerites, or he died, you know, of an illness there, his wife, who is one of the Whitmer sisters, stayed there, her family stayed Whitmerite. George Miller, who was one of the early presiding bishops, he ended up being a Whiteite and then a Strangite. John Page ended up being a Hedrickite. William Marks, who joined a lot of the different churches. William McClellan. John Johnson didn't go very far. And then Jesse Goss, where'd he go? I don't know if you remember him. He's one of the early members of the First Presidency, and then they're like, what happened to Jesse Goss, right? Actually, Metcalf. No, his wife. Aaron Metcalf, I'm sorry. Aaron Metcalf has actually found that out, so we can just read her journal article. So anyway, in short, there were many more paths than one, right? And it wasn't just that one map that is the path. So how do we get beyond, you know, that traditional Mormon history map like this one? So one of the ways that I tried to do it was I made this book where we drill down and we'd look at the settlements really closely. So this is Caldwell County, the time period that they are in when they're at Far West, so Hans Mill and Far West. And so what I did was I looked at all the different landownings, and each one of these is the property records, the names of the early saints that were in each one of those farms that they had bought in all the township across the whole county. And so when you do this, you're able to find out that my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Stephen Nancy Winchester, they may well have had a farm right next to yours. So Charles C. Rich, you know, they lived right next to there. And so you can kind of find out different things, and you realize, wait a second, these guys maybe were right next to each other, and maybe that's why they all went off and been Whiteites together. In other words, they had something where those kind of connections that are made because of geography end up also influencing the history. And so from that, we were able to kind of tell things like, for example, their claim was that they had to expand into the other counties that threatened all of the Gentiles and everything like that. And that's one of the things that provoked the Mormon-Missouri War, because the county was full. Well, one of the things that looking at the land records showed was, well, the county wasn't yet full, but maybe they were anticipating that it would be. You could kind of tell where they were settling. You could tell who was the largest purchasers, you know, people who stayed. So in other words, people who, maybe there were a lot of people who at every single one of these places didn't move on to the next place. So the Whitmers, but all of these different landowners ended up staying there. So the next thing, though, way of looking at this is what I call schematic maps. And so even though we are very, very, very plugged into Cartesian maps, like the Mercator projection, where we are really worrying about visualizing everything through this late medieval idea and invention of maps, which was designed for sea travel. And so in other words, where we're really worried about where the coastline is and that sort of thing, even though most of us don't get to the coast very much. There are other ways that they used to make maps, which are schematic. And so, for example, this is a map, one of the most beautiful little medieval maps, and you recognize it immediately as it's a world map, right? The Earth. And so, but in part, you can tell, the way you can understand it is, so this map is, it has east at the top, because of course all Roman and Christian maps were oriented with east to the top. The center of the world here is Jerusalem. The whole northern half of this is called a TO map, and so there's this O of a circle of the lands, the globe of the earth. The medieval people all knew that the world was a sphere. Nobody had any illusions that the world was flat. That's a modern myth about Middle Ages. So there's a circle of the lands, and then there's a T. And the T is a training way of telling the orientation of the earth. So the top half of the circle is Asia, and then the two quarters are Europe and Africa. And that's the known world, the world known to the Roman Empire, and so that's what was still what was known to all medieval people who were the heirs of the Roman Empire. And since they'd become Christian, they saw Jerusalem there at the center of that world, and of course, Christ above it. So what they're trying to show here is something like not so much where the coastlines are. You would never use this for navigating. Nobody was using it for that purpose, but rather to show where you are in the world, what's your place in the world, how is that world oriented towards God. So, and we don't have to go through all of the wonderful map. I love that map. Anyway, this is, like I say, this is a TO diagram. And one of the ways I always show that people in the Middle Ages knew that the world was a sphere is if you've ever seen, like, the Queen of England has this sphere that she holds that's got a cross on the top. You know, in Monty Python, it's called the Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch. You know, anyway. And so the Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch is a sphere because you're showing your sovereign authority of the world. All right. A schematic map like we might use today, this is a famous one, you have it for your tracks map, you know, which is to say you don't want to show, you don't care exactly cartesianally how everything works in the track system. What you care about is where can you have an interchange or something like that. And so it's drawn schematically as opposed to with Cartesian accuracy. And so a schematic map that we often have in the Latter-day Saint movement and Mormonism is the one of the plan of salvation. And so this is one you're probably familiar with. You probably have drawn this on a chalkboard, or at least you've had a valiant teacher draw it on your chalkboard or something like that to explain it. Pre-existence, earth life, paradise, prison, judgment, and the 3 degrees of glory, outer darkness. In the RLDS tradition, there's also a schematic maps. So there was a teaching tool that always happened, which is there's the straight and narrow way, and then there's the broad way that leads you to all the different kinds of apostasy, including the great apostasy that happened after the death of the apostles and Jesus, and then, of course, the latter-day apostasy with Brigham Young and all of those apostates. So those were schematic maps. Other maps that have happened is, like I mentioned with the Book of Mormon, originally when people started doing these maps, they did it schematically, since in fact the book is probably, like I say, has an itinerary in mind. So actually everything is relational as opposed to any particular location that it might actually be meant on the actual physical world. And so some of the early maps are schematic. More recently, for example, this is a schematic map that actually, though, has behind it, the person has an idea that they think of where it actually is. But and then other people have come up with different ways now to put different, where you can map the Book of Mormon that way. This one puts it so that Toronto is right in a good place. There's too many of those maps. This is the one that when I was six that I made with my sister. They're cute. All that stuff. So I've been interested in maps and mapping for a whole long time. I'm not going to show you mine. This is my Book of Mormon map. So I'll just show it to you quickly. So the land northward and southward, it's all set in the coming forth of the Book of Mormon area from Palmyra and the Hill Cumorah down to Harmony with Zarahemla on the river. And the narrow neck of land is between these two lakes, which is where the Whitmers were in Fayette. So anyway, that's my... It's not the way... Nobody had that in their mind when they were writing the book or composing the book, but it's kind of cool. So I like it. That's my map. Okay. So how do we do these kind of schematic maps? So this is another way of doing a schematic one. So we use this when people come to Kirtland Temple, when LDS people come to Kirtland Temple, and they may well have, let's say, their entire temple experience may well be the Columbus, Ohio temple. When they do that, they are used to things like endowments and other portions of temple work, baptisms for the dead. They're used to spaces devoted for that, right? And so, but then they go to Kirtland Temple and they wonder, well, when did those RLDS people take out the font? You know, when did they, I mean, obviously we didn't take out the movie theater, but in other words, when did you make it so that all of these, the temple work is no longer being able to be done here? And so what I try to show with this schematic diagram, conceptual diagram, is when the Kirtland Temple is made, there is a completely different conception of what temples are in the Latter-day Saint movement. And so essentially there is there's three levels. You know, there's a level here for a place of worship. There's a level for a place of education, the training of the elders and high school and things like that. And then there's a headquarters level where the office is, like Joseph Smith's office. When you get to Nauvoo, that's maintained. And if you go to the replica Nauvoo temple, they've kept an inner lower court in it. There's a replica inside it. There would have been two in the real one, and they would have been bigger. But essentially, they've made that homage to the original Nauvoo temple. But the original Nauvoo temple space would have been dominated by those two upper and lower courts, just like in Kirtland. The way it works is that because of the space, there's a crawl space in Kirtland temple, but this temple is scaled up and big enough. These are to scale. So that you were able to put the offices in the mezzanine level, and so that's why I put the headquarters in there. And now they've added in the basement the font, and in the attic the space for doing the endowment and other rituals like sealing. And so when you come to Salt Lake, I didn't know the inside. This diagram's a little wrong compared to how the inside works. I've never been inside. But anyway, now I've seen it at the visitor center. You can see how it lays out. But anyway, essentially, though, there's maintained this assembly hall, the solemn assembly, and it actually has Kirtland as its model, even though it's much more late Victorian in its styling. But then the whole bulk of it, and there's still offices for the 12, the leadership of the LDS Church and everything like that. So there's a little bit, it's not the official headquarters, which is across the street, but there still has that maintained. There's the font. And so in other words, the bulk of the space is given over for these areas that were quite marginal, the basement and the attic in Nauvoo. And then the little temples really only have that part, right? And so if you've come and you've only been in one of the little temples and you go to Kirtland, you don't see anything to do with your temple experience in it. And so it's odd that way, right? The opposite is, you know, so in Community of Christ, we went back and took Kirtland as our model, right? And so in this restoration grab bag of all the different things that were done in the early time period, we, as opposed to maintaining the Nauvoo innovations, that's been our thing. So it's still the headquarters of the church. It's the center of our education system, the library, the archives, the temple school are all based there. And, of course, the sanctuary is for special worship services. I do this when I show. I like to show this because I just find it so fascinating. But essentially, this is another way that you can structurally show the church history. Essentially, and the structure of the church priesthood-wise in 1830 has the whole of three offices, which are teacher, priest, and elder. And elders are known, according to the DNC, as elders are apostles. And the leader of the church is the first elder, and the second elder is his assistant. But, you know, all the way 3 years later, and suddenly you have all of these ideas that there's now higher priesthood and a lower priesthood. There's an idea that people are set apart to the higher priesthood that later becomes high priest. We have a presidents of the high priesthood that later becomes a first presidency. We have bishops who are financial officers over Zion, which is to say Missouri, and Kirtland. And then you also have the pastors, which are to say the presiding elders of each of the individual branches, and we've added deacons. So in other words, already things are very different. This is a rapidly evolving faith in just 3 years, but fast forward 2 years later, you know, and then the structure is again, you know, wildly more complicated. So now we understand that the higher priesthood is a Melchizedek priesthood, the lower priesthood is Aaronic. Elders get upgraded to Melchizedek. You know, we have these high councils, standing high council, the high council, the traveling high council of the 12, and we now have patriarch evangelists. So anyway, and what I also kind of show then is if we take that diagram, those were all people, let's say, as of 1835 when they all get filled, all those offices. So we have here, you know, again, at the top, the first presidency, the presidency of the headquarters in Kirtland, the presidency of the church in Missouri, and the traveling high council of the 12, the patriarch, that's if you can't read all those, the bishopric, and the presidents of 70. I forgot, we have 70s. I'm a 70 now. I should have remembered that. So anyway, 70s. So anyway, all of those represent people, so I put their names in. So then when we take that, and we take that diagram from the 1835 people and all of those people, and we look fast forward to when Brigham Young reorganizes his first presidency in Council Bluffs, Iowa in 1847, the people in that whole thing who are in orange, those are people that have maintained or they're now chosen Brigham Young and they are loyal to him. The one that all went dark are people that have died. The people in gray there have people that have left the movement altogether, and then the people that are blue, you know, there have all gone into different branches, so non-Brighamite. So you can see that even in that early grouping of early leaders and authorities of the church, there is a separation. People have split up by the end of the first generation period here, or at least of Joseph Smith period. So one of the ways I tried to show that is way back when we put together a book called Scattering of the Saints, Schism Within Mormonism. And so I made this on the cover of it, as you can go and see it over there because you'll be able to pick out this image, right? So on the cover, we made a schematic diagram of how all the branches or how the major branches kind of interrelate to each other, because we wanted to show that. And one of the ways I did it this way is I didn't want to show or even use this term break off, because when people separate in communion, even if it's just a small group and a big group, you are not doing it because you are inspired by the devil or these guys, the big group, are, even though that's what the rhetoric often was. Rather, people, when they separate in communion from each other, they feel like they have very serious reasons for their interpretation of what God is calling them to do, and they can't be in communion with each other anymore. And in some ways, you know, a 20-person church that is very zealous right now that may have emerged from a larger group only last year, they also have a heritage that goes all the way back to 1830, you know, even if their church organization and structure may only be 6 months old right now, right? And so everybody is all part of this, and that's what I tried to show in a diagram like this. And so I've made a bunch of these. This is one that, very early one that I made, and it used to be, they had a copy of it at the church history department here a while back anyway. Another way I've shown it is to show this constellation of Mormonism diagram, which shows the kind of the relative sizes. Obviously, the one church is very, very big. Community of Christ is, you know, not that big, but bigger than all the other ones. And then there's a constellation of about 10 that have in the thousands of members. And then there's maybe 80 that are large enough to field a congregation. I'm not going to show that. And so anyway, one of the other things that ways I've tried to do that, just to show this kind of thing going, this one is moving from left to right, but essentially bringing together like those early branches, bringing together Sidney Rigdon's church. There's Jesse Gause as the first presidency in Kirtland. Anyway, this path that's going forth and different groups that are emerging from it as maybe the central path, or at least the largest path, is going on in the middle. To the point where we get to Nauvoo here. So essentially, at Missouri time, the Whitmer family, George Hinkle, the Brewsterites, you can see Warren Parrish, the schism that happens in Kirtland when Kirtland collapses. From all of those, from the time period when Joseph Smith is killed, that's when the major branches now that are still extant today are all separate from each other. So in other words, none of the early branches that left or whatever went into schism before Joseph Smith's death, none of those are extant. But today there are multiple major branches that are still survived from the 1844 moment. And so one of them is the Rigdonites. And so they've had a couple different iterations, but essentially the circles here are historic ones and the stars here is present day. And so right now the Church of Jesus Christ, headquartered in Monongahela, Pennsylvania, which we tend to call the Bickertonite Church. There's actually a representative who's a Bickertonite here who did a presentation at Sunstone. It's really wonderful that we have so many different Latter-day Saint tradition churches here. And so they're one of the branches that has been most isolated from the rest of us. So whereas a lot of branches are either hanging out here in Utah or the Utah area and therefore in the shadow of the LDS Church, or frankly hanging out around the center place in Jackson County, Missouri, and are therefore reacting to what the RLDS Church has been doing. So whereas that, these guys have been off in Pennsylvania and they've been the one and only true church there, and they have just been doing their own thing this whole time. And as a result, they're really, really interesting and have their own take that goes back to kind of a Kirtland era Latter-day Saintism. One of the things that I'm not going to show that. Not enough time for all that. There's a million slides, so don't worry. We can talk about all this. Another one is the Strangites. So the Strangites were initially really, really James Strang and ultimately emerged as like the major challenger to Brigham Young, and he gathered all kinds of people to his church. But at a certain point, because his claim was based on angelic ordination and where he was saying that Joseph Smith was a prophet not because somebody like an apostle or somebody, you know, ordained him to that high office. Apostles can't ordain people to be prophets. You can't have a deacon ordain a priest. That's crazy talk. So in that same way, the same way that Joseph Smith got that same ordination, so did I. And so because of that, though, when he died, and nobody, no angel came back to ordain a successor, that he'd never had a successor. And so they have continued on in a very, mostly, most everybody has joined the reorganization as a result of that. But a small group and a very wonderful active congregation continues on in Voree, Wisconsin, which is their old traditional headquarters. Love all those people. You know, of course, we're very much more familiar with the mainline branch, the Brighamite branch, which includes, though, not only the church, the LDS church here, but also, that last line there that's coming off of John Taylor and Lauren Woolley, which is to say the fundamentalist Mormons. And we usually try not to say the polygamist churches, because the fact is that not everybody who is in one of these churches is actually a polygamist. So we had a group of fundamentalist missionaries from one of the churches, one that is here, and you know, people are saying, "Well, so you guys are polygamists?" Well, they actually aren't, because they're 18 and 19, right? They're not married. But anyway, so that's why, in other words, they're fundamentalist churches, and of course, those have continued to have multiple organizations. The FLDS Church is simply the most famous because of the news, because of the Warren Jeffs, but actually the United Apostolic Brethren is probably the largest one. Cutlerites, the ones that everyone loves and is most intrigued by, because they're the one non-Brighamite group that maintains a Nauvoo-era endowment, and they do it, and they keep it very secret. They won't tell us about it. They won't tell anybody about it. And when you have a secret, then everybody is very excited about it. And so essentially there are more scholars camped around the Cutlerite church and then there are Cutlerites. There's like six Cutlerites, and they got about 20 scholars that are just like outside, you know, like this. So... Josephites. So one of the things that happened in the reorganization is that the reorganization was actually really quite successful in gathering the different groups, including ex-Brighamites, people who came out here who didn't like the way things were going during the Mormon Reformation and other things, and they went back across the plains, or they went on to San Bernardino, and those became reorganization centers, gathering all that together. But in more recent years, the reorganization has also, because it was in some ways a group of dissenters, it has also branched out, and so there are people, for example, who have churches that did not want to ordain women, and so now they have different churches that are Josephite churches that are not part of the Community of Christ. The Hedrickites are their own incredible array of branches, but essentially we know the one that's most famous that you think of is the Temple Lot Church. So they're the people that have the Temple Lot, and they're on the Temple Lot, and you know, and they're never going to sell the Temple Lot, and the Temple Lot, it is not mortgaged, etc., and as the central thing there in their identity. But there's actually been multiple different groups that have come off from that, that including Pauline Hancock's church, where she was the first female leader of a Latter-day Saint denomination, and that church went so kind of progressive and liberal that they ultimately, you know, they decided the Book of Mormon was not historic and shouldn't be scripture. They decanonized it. They ultimately decided that the restoration tradition itself, Joseph Smith, was not actually a valid thing. Then they voted that out, and they voted themselves out of existence. So they actually went that way. And then conversely, in terms of the kind of crazy right-wing way you can go, there's one of these has become essentially a white identity, a neo-Nazi church. And so from the same origins, you can get to very, very different outcomes. Other ones, the Whiteites, sadly, and the Whitmerites lasted all the way up till the 1960s. But anyway, they are now no longer extant. So I'm not going to go through this whole one. Well, what time is it? Okay, so I'll just show this real quick. Essentially, what I wanted to show is another way that I would love to be able to do this, and I haven't done it yet. This is essentially just an idea of how one could do it is, you know, because We can't. How do we show all this context, and how do we show this story of the fact that it's not just about the headquarters? It should. When we talk about early Mormon history, it should not just be a Joseph Smith biography, and yet we always write it as one. In fact, what happened was my ancestors, your ancestors maybe, they all joined, and they may not have even ever gathered to Nauvoo or anything. They may have lived in the branches. The bulk of the membership at any given time won't have lived, you know, in camped around Salt Lake City or something like that. They're living in branches in any other place. And so one of the things I would love to have shown is a map that is showing as much as is humanly possible. We don't have perfect evidence of where all those branches would be, but different events, and also then tracking the background of what the let's say the context is. So in 1830, the borders are different, right? And so I'll just go through it real fast. But essentially, as the church is organized here, you know, and there's little branches, there's a Lamanite mission, Kirtland becomes a gathering place, Jackson County becomes a gathering place, there's branches are forming, then they would incur opposition, they're getting kicked out of Jackson County, they move to Clay County, that's a gathering camp, the Zion's Camp, in other words, events like this. Zion's Camp fails, that causes dissent, so a lot of people leave. You know, context is happening around, so Texas is declaring independence anyway. This kind of change is happening. Kirtland Temple dedication, far west, more branches. Kirtland Bank fails, the dissent in Kirtland, the church is splitting apart. There's a new church now, Warren Parish Church of Christ. It's no longer in communion with the mainline church, let's say. That kind of thing is happening. Missouri Mormon War. Everybody's getting kicked out. They flee to Illinois. Nauvoo is now the headquarters. William Law, the expositor, the martyrdom. Now suddenly, you know, Rigdon is, you know, kicked out. Strang is now announcing his ordination. Reorganizations of other churches, the Whitmerites, or early version of them. Going west for the Brighamites. Mormon Battalion. Dissent among the Strangites. The Whiteites have declared again their own church. Thompsonites, Brewsterites, Williamites, Utah Territory, this sort of thing. The reorganization, the Cutlerites, getting kicked out of Beaver Island, the Hedrickites. Civil War, we forget, there's context here, right? You know, that's happening when all this thing is happening. When the reorganization is happening, one of the reasons why the church becomes a peace church, they're living in the Midwest during this whole Civil War time, right? The Bickertonites. So, anyway, this kind of thing could go on and on and on, and it's really cool. So, the way I would like to do that, though, is by doing something like this. This is a study of all the times different branches and different branch locations are mentioned in the times and seasons. And so, as we start to kind of do those things and we can kind of start to see branch maps and where everything is located, you know, we can get a different kind of and bigger picture of let's say, a different way of mapping all of the many Mormonisms, one that isn't just focused like a laser beam on leaders and things like that, but is actually talking about all of our experience. So, thank you very much.
Great. Awesome. Well, we have about just a little over 15 minutes for questions. So, if you do have a question, you can come on up to the mic. And please try to keep your questions brief so we can get to the answers.
Hi.
Is it true that James Strang actually had a set of physical plates that could be seen with physical eyes?
Yes.
And
so the question,
what happened to those?
So the question is like, did James Strang have a set of physical plates that could be seen? So James Strang had two sets of plates. The original set that he encountered in Voree, they dug up, and his witnesses dug up, and the witnesses attested to the fact that they dug it up when Strang wasn't around, and although he told them where they would be. And then they were a physical object that were not only seen by those witnesses, but by like 1,000 people in Burlington, Wisconsin. And so we can be quite assured that they're a physical artifact, including the guy who invented the typewriter, who was a local reporter, went and saw him. And so what happened to those plates? Those are translated. Those do not become the Book of the Law of the Lord. They become the, it's a very short text that's the story of the Raja Manchu of Vorito. So anyway, it predicts essentially the coming of a prophet to this place, so James Strang. So it predicts James Strang's ministry, but it is not anything longer than that. Those particular ones were in the possession of one of Strang's plural wives, and she had them as late as the late 19th century in Davis City, Iowa, which is right next to Lamoni, Iowa, and we don't know what happened after that. The story is, in lore, we don't have this, I don't know, is that two elders knocked on her door and wanted to see him. She loaned it to them, and they're maybe in the vault in Salt Lake, for all we know. But anyway, we don't know what happened to them. They fall out of the record at that point. So we have good facsimiles of them, and actually they're very, very interesting, because in addition to being a physical artifact that you could hold, as opposed to the characters diagram, which may well just be totally indecipherable anyway, whether it's just scribbles or whatever you may want to say about the transcript from the Book of Mormon, the Anthem transcript, as it's called, that this community of Christ has, it is entirely decipherable. So it is its own non-English alphabet that is written in Boustrophedon, so it goes left to right, then right to left, then left to right, then right to left. But there's problems with it too. But anyway, but it is an interesting thing, because you can actually, it matches up word for word for word with James Strang's translation of it.
Is that the one that's reproduced on their website?
That you probably have seen that one, because that's the only one we have a facsimile of. He later got other plates. He got a hold of the brass plates that are mentioned in the Book of Mormon. And I don't know if people actually had a physical artifact for that or not. I'm not sure about that. We certainly don't have a facsimile of the brass plates. And so I don't know about the brass plates, if there was a physical artifact. But the brass plates, he translated, and it became the Book of the Law of the Lord, which is the fourth book of Scripture for the Strangites. It's a very interesting book. It is essentially, Strang is one of the most brilliant early Mormons, I think, and he has assimilated like all Mormon ideas and fixed so many things in Mormon theology that were left maybe unthought of, or the logical consequences weren't considered as of 1844. So, for example, in the course of the Book of the Law of the Lord, it's pretty well explained that how monotheism works again. So God is God, and God does not in progression, but Jesus Christ was the first exalted man who became a God. And so essentially the Strangites are adoptionists, which is to say that God adopted a perfect man, and then Jesus is our model, therefore. But that doesn't renounce monotheism the way progression does. So if you think that God the Father, Elohim, was once a man, that means you've essentially said that God isn't infinite and all-powerful. God is simply somebody who's gaining in glory like us. So it's a very interesting thing. So Strang had a really, really interesting thing, and they maintain it. They became Seventh-day Sabbatarians. They still meet there in Voree, and they read the Book of the Law of the Lord together, and they ask what they think of this and the means. It's a really neat place, and they're so welcoming. They're wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to take a couple. Okay, I'm sorry. I got to go faster. Now I got to answer. Go ahead.
Thank you for your presentation. My question was that: what was that sect in Pennsylvania that was isolated?
The Bickertonites is what we call them, but actually they're called the Church of Jesus Christ, and sometimes we say the Church of Jesus Christ with headquarters in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. The person who reorganized it is William Bickerton, which is why everybody who's not them calls them the Bickertonites. But essentially Bickerton had been one of the apostles of Rigdon in Rigdon's church, original church. He then later had a different Rigdonite church himself.
Okay, I wondered if you could tell us more about them. Like, do they hold to the historicity of the Book of Mormon? Do they ordain women? Do they have polygamy?
Historicity in the Book of Mormon, yes. Polygamy, they're against it. They have interesting things like foot washing. They do speaking in tongues. They do a thing like the Mormons don't like to have read prayers. So you have to do praying by the Spirit in a sacrament meeting. In a Bickertonite one, you cannot speak by read talks. You need to be speaking by the Spirit. They don't have. They don't conduct worship services with a, by a bulletin. They do it by the Spirit. So essentially, you're the stake president or whatever, and you're saying, Sister Hannah, do you want to come up and speak on tithing? You know, and really, you've got to be on your toes. It is a lively service. I was sitting there, and I'm just like, "What's up? What am I going to say when he calls on me?" You know, what I mean, I don't know. You know, so I was, you know, so it's exciting. It's interesting. Yeah.
Thanks.
I came in late, a few minutes late, so forgive me if you've already addressed this. But as I walked in, you were talking about the maps of the U.S. and how they simply just ignored the Native American population.
Yes.
And so that, it gets to a question I have about your inclusion criteria. So if I caught it right, the circles that have the jagged edges are living leaders, the current living leaders of restoration
yeah.
traditions. And also if my eyes got it, you've got Sandra Tanner as the living leader of a restoration tradition.
Sandra Tanner, you know, the Hedrickites are a really interesting tradition, right? And so when I mentioned Pauline Hancock's church, the basement church that she had, in Independence. So that church it was in schism from the Temple Lot Church. So it's a Hedrickite tradition church, Pauline Hancock. So they did this thing where they were doing all kinds of, it was like a study group, and they were getting like microfilms of all of the things like the Book of Commandments and things like that. And so Gerald Tanner and Sandra Tanner met at a Pauline Hancock church gathering, I'm given to understand, and that one of the reasons why they were studying all the things that became modern microfilm and that kind of thing is because that church was doing that. And then they didn't stay with that, and so whether or not she's in a restoration tradition church herself now, the Utah Lighthouse Ministry has rejected all restoration distinctives, but is entirely focused on the movement still. And so whether or not that still counts, it certainly has its origins, interestingly, in a Temple Lot tradition church, the first one that, like I say, had a woman as the leader and that ultimately voted itself out of existence.
So what I wanted to, like, what are your general criteria for what is included? You know, putting yourself in an analogous position to the map makers looking at the U.S. or what becomes the U.S., how do you decide what's in and what's out?
Yeah, what's in and what's out. So in that particular case, I think that diagram, I made that line go gray. So in other words, the other ones are all a particular color. So I'm trying to show multiple things all at once. And so every one of the colors that I pick, when I have this diagram here, there's a reason why I didn't just pick all those colors at random. So what I'm essentially trying to say here is, as I was showing, that the church is constantly evolving. So you have that New York period where you just have the three priesthood offices and you don't even have a church organized yet, and then you have this Missouri and Kirtland period, and you have this Nauvoo period, and then you have this secret Nauvoo period of polygamy and that kind of a thing. And so I'm showing that there from blue to green to orange, and then going on from that to, let's say, more fundamentalist distinctives, and that's getting orange and red. Whereas what we're saying here is, okay, but then it goes back. It takes a step back on the mainline church, back to kind of a yellow. They've abandoned polygamy and some of the other things, the law of adoption, all those kind of things that church has abandoned. Meanwhile, a lot of the other churches, like the Rigdonites, that branch there, the Bictorianites, that's that blue branch that goes down, the Community of Christ, the green branch going back to Missouri, you know, the Whitmerites going back to blue, you know, the Tedrickites, and then Strangites, again, adding things like the Book of the Law of the Lord. So they've gone in their own direction and it's purple now. So I'm trying to show all those things at once. How do I include them? I feel like that church, since it had those historic origins, so even the one that has become, let's say, a white identity church, in some ways, it's still the same people. There's some continuity. There's always continuity and innovation. And what I'm trying to show here is, you know, like how they're all sort of branching out and still connected, even though they are distinct things now. And we'll do the last one.
I just wanted to hear briefly your perspective on authority and the keys of the priesthood, you know, from the perspective of the Community of Christ, if possible, at the time of the schism and what happened there, and what's your perspective on it now?
Okay, so authority and keys from the time of the time at the time then. So at the time then, the Community of Christ wouldn't, the RLDS Church would not have believed that this, for example, this final charge of the 12. Referred to any particular set of, that was been denied that those keys had any particular relevance or anything like that. The church was organized before any of those keys. That's all relates to the kingdom. So the priesthood is organized first, then the church, then the kingdom. So some of those kingdom keys and things like that aren't particularly relevant to church structure. You know, all of the church was organized without anything like that. And so rather than whether that large charge, which actually was given to the Council of 50, which is to say to the kingdom. So it was the 50 that had those, not the 12 were all members of the 50, but they misremembered it or they said it as if it was to them as opposed to the 50. For the reorganization, the point was the church. And according to church canon, there's a scripture in the DNC which is, if Joseph Smith shall fall, then he'll have no power save it be to appoint another in his stead. There are multiple occasions when he appointed another in his stead, which is to say Joseph III, and those have a lot of different witnesses, including the last thing that he did before he left Nauvoo was he gave another special blessing to Joseph III and went off to Carthage after that. So that was their that was the reorganization's take on it at the time. And it's more complicated. There's a lot more arguments. I mean, the polemics went on and on for 60 years or, you know, actually 100 years. And so where are we now? So now, for me, is that I think that keys are open to all. When Joseph is reading a scripture and he's saying, ask and it shall be open to you, seek and you'll find, you know, knock and it'll be open to you, seek and you'll find, ask and you'll be answered. When you're seeing that, that isn't a coded phrase that was just to Joseph Smith or whatever. That wasn't included in the letter of James, just for Joseph Smith. Rather, it is for all of us, you know. And so, the Grove experience does not bestow exclusive authority on Joseph Smith and Community of Christ tradition. Instead, what it is it's an exemplar, just like Moses at the burning bush. It's how every single one of us is open to being able to have a vision or envisioning, to have that personal connection with the divine, because every single one of us, you know, is God's child, and nobody, should be put above anybody else. In other words, you should not be worshiping a man, because then you've created an idol for yourself and put something between you and God. Rather, so everyone will have those keys if you ask. And so is, I think, the way I would interpret it. And then everybody in Community of Christ is different, but that's how I would do it. So thank you. Thank you all again.